It's 1700 on a cold, starlit night in December 1942. Royal Navy submarine HMS Tuna is surfacing from the dark waters of the Atlantic, 2.5 miles from the coast of German-occupied France. As the main engines stop, a small group of men, led by Major Blondie Hasler, make their final preparations for one of the most daring and courageous operations of the entire Second World War. With a humble canoe as their weapon, Operation Frankton is underway. Within minutes, Hasler's elite unit is silently paddling into the heart of enemy territory. Their mission? Navigate the treacherous waters of the Bay of Biscay, enter the most heavily defended estuary in Europe, dodge searchlights, machine gun posts, armed river patrol craft, and then blow up enemy shipping in Bordeaux Harbour.
The odds against them were overwhelming. This was a mission from which many believed they would never return. And they knew it. This was a suicide mission by any other name.
But Blondie Hasler's Mission Impossible is far more than just a boy's own adventure of heroism against the odds. It is a tale of deceit, duplication, and massive Whitehall cock-up.
It is also the story of how a daring raid on the coast of France damaged our enemy at a desperate time for our country and taught us vital lessons in the planning and execution of the greatest sea invasion in history, D-Day.
The most courageous raid of World War II, a Time Watch special, presented by Paddy Ashdown. A city ablaze.
3 years into the Second World War, Britain's fortunes had taken a decided turn for the worse. We'd endured the Blitz, the humiliating retreat from Dunkirk, and we were now facing the threat of starvation in the Battle of the Atlantic. Britain was losing the war, and Churchill knew it.
We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Churchill's rhetoric of the early war years now seemed wildly out of date. The army was in disarray, the RAF had only just enough planes to defend the country, and the Navy was at full stretch protecting vital Atlantic convoys. Churchill was on the back foot.
Churchill's options at this time of the war were savagely limited. As Prime Minister and Minister of Defence, he too was under siege. After a string of defeats, there was real pressure here in Whitehall and in the country at large for him to stand down, if not as Prime Minister, then at least as Minister of Defence.
But this was Winston Churchill, and surrendering office was not an option. Instead, he decided to set Europe ablaze by creating two new secret armies, the Special Operations Executive and Combined Operations. Churchill was always at his most resourceful when under fire.
Churchill had to find ways of hitting back at the enemy fast, and combined ops and SOE were two of the tools that he devised for doing it. They were set up at about the same time with parallel missions.
SOE's role was primarily one of sabotage and subversion inland, while combined operations brought together the skills of the Air Force, the Army and the Navy to wreak havoc along the enemy coastline. Churchill knew that in the absence of the resources for a second front against the Germans, pinprick assaults on the enemy were all that Britain could manage at this time. An unlikely model for these raids came from the Italians, who had done great damage by using human torpedoes, they called them pigs, and exploding motorboats. Now this was the sort of ingenuity and inventiveness that Churchill was after. On the 19th of January, he wrote to his Chiefs of Staff Committee Please report what is being done to emulate the exploits of the Italians. Far from the corridors of Whitehall, one man was already working on new ideas to fight the enemy. His name was Blondie Hasler. Hasler was an extraordinary, contradictory, even eccentric spirit. A loner who lived his life on his own terms, yet who believed in the discipline and convention of service life.
I met Blondie Hasler once. We shared the same compartment on a train when I was going back to join my old unit, the Special Boat Service, in Poole. He asked me a series of what I frankly thought were pretty intrusive questions about what I did. Not having a clue who he was, I rather rudely refused to answer. It was only later that I learnt that I had shared my compartment with one of the most extraordinary Special Force commanders of the Second World War, and by the way, a personal hero. Even today, the memory makes me shiver with embarrassment.
In the early 1940s, Hasler had a radical new and surprising idea. It involved the use of canoes to take the fight directly to the enemy. He proposed this to the Admiralty, but they turned him down. Now, with Churchill's demand for new initiatives, Hasler's plans were suddenly of interest, especially to the newly appointed head of combined operations, Commander Louis Mountbatten. Mountbatten ordered Hasler to come and see him as soon as possible. The humble canoe was about to be turned into a weapon of war.
Paddy enters a wood-paneled room.
When Blondie Hasler entered the headquarters of combined operations here in Whitehall, he was introduced to Louis Mountbatten. Mountbatten told him, "We've brought you here because you seem to know a lot about small boats and have some very interesting ideas on how to use them. So, are you keen to take a shot at this job?" "Very keen, sir," said Hasler. "Good. I'm sure you'll fit in very well." For Blondie Hasler, the story started right here.
Soldiers marching in a stately building's parade ground.
In March 1942, Hasler was put in charge of a new elite unit.
In a reconstruction, Blondie Hasler descends steps from the building.
Open order.
Their cover name was the Royal Marines Boom Patrol Detachment.
The drill master readies the men for Blondie's inspection and then marches over to salute him.
What Hasler asked for were men who were intelligent, nimble, of good physique, able to swim free of strong family ties, eager to engage the enemy. But most important of all, they had to be indifferent to their personal safety.
When Hasler interviewed the men for his new unit, he asked them all this question. "Why did you volunteer for hazardous service?" "To avenge my brother, sir," said Bill Sparks. His brother had just been killed on active service in Crete. Hasler then made a chilling prediction. "You do realize that if you join my unit, your chances of a long life are very remote."
Norman Colley, the last remaining member of Operation Frankton.
"What do you say to that? You just accept it and that's it." And that saying stuck in my... I don't know if they said it to all of them, but that stuck in my mind and I never forgot it. "Do you realise that your expectations of a long life are very remote?" So you knew you were going into danger, but you're 20, you don't care.
The truth was, at this stage of the war, those who volunteered for hazardous service with Hasler were, as he later said, just a good cross-section of average young fellows. We had to do the best with what was offered to us. As a leader, Hasler always inspired his men by example, never asking any of them to do something which he hadn't first done himself.
They run with canoes over shingle.
The day after their arrival, Hasler's team began in earnest, with their commander throwing them literally in at the deep end by sending them out to sea in canoes. The results were predictably disastrous. All of them capsized and had to drag themselves and their canoes back to the beach. He told them, do it again, and then again, and again, until they could do it.
Eventually, they're paddling 6 two-man canoes with ease.
You know he was good at his job. You'd fail him. I'd have gone anywhere with him. I would. No worry at all. I wouldn't have given a second thought. If he'd have asked me to do anything, I'd have done it.
Unknown to Hasler and his team, his unit would soon be providing a solution to a major strategic challenge that was preoccupying the chiefs of staff in Whitehall. In May, Churchill received a memo from his newly appointed Minister for Economic Warfare, Lord Selborne.
Most secret, blockade running between Germany and the Far East is likely to increase. Everything practicable should be done.
The memo highlighted how convoys of German cargo ships were increasingly outrunning British warships whose job it was to intercept them at sea. These so-called blockade runners travel between the Far East and Europe, carrying supplies including rubber, molybdenum, tin, and tungsten, all vital for the German war machine.
A successful blockade increasingly depended not just on attacking them at sea, but also hitting them in their ports, especially the port of Bordeaux.
70 miles from the Atlantic coast, Bordeaux sits at the end of Europe's largest estuary, the Gironde. In 1942, it harbored not only the blockade runners, but also German and Italian U-boats, crucial for German victory in the Battle of the Atlantic. Not surprisingly, the estuary was formidably defended by around 10,000 German troops. In effect, Bordeaux was one huge military camp and provided an ideal base for the blockade runners. So the question was, how could Bordeaux Harbour be attacked? The Admiralty was asked, but they said the port was far too far up, a heavily defended estuary for any chance of success. The RAF agreed bombing would simply not be accurate enough and cause unacceptable civilian casualties. And a military operation would need both ships and 50,000 men, far more than Britain could find at this time in the war. How to hit the blockade runners became known as the Bordeaux problem. With conventional solutions ruled out, Churchill and his chiefs of staff began to think the unthinkable. With so much at stake, could perhaps thinking small be the answer? On the 21st of September 1942, Blondie Hasler was ordered back to the Combined Operations Headquarters in London. Here he was given the file on the Bordeaux problem, now rechristened Operation Frankton. Overnight, he drew up a plan to use his canoes to blow up the blockade runners lying alongside the quays of Bordeaux. Within weeks, Hasler's plan had been approved by Louis Mountbatten, but with one big exception. Mountbatten said Hasler couldn't go. He was just too valuable.
Mountbatten asked Hasler, so why do you want to lead this raid yourself? Hasler replied, well, as we both know, sir, this is a very important mission and we have to field our best team. My unit has been training on small boats for months now, but I've been doing it all my life. It's only natural that I'm better at it than they are. Mountbatten smiled. All right. Against my better judgment, I'm going to let you go.
Hasler now finalized his force. 12 men, 6 canoes, each canoe named after a fish. In Catfish was Blondie Hasler and the 20-year-old Bill Sparks, a cobbler and a cockney, known as Ned. In Cuttlefish, Lieutenant Jack McKinnon, a clerk from Oban in Scotland, and James Conway, a milkman from Stockport. He was known as Jim. In Coldfish, 20-year-old Robert Ewart from Glasgow. Bobby had worked in the textile industry and was devoted to his sweetheart, Heather. With Bobby, Sergeant Samuel Wallace. Sam was a Dublin-born ex-builders merchant. Congo was crewed by Corporal George Sheard, known as Jan, and David Moffat, a former Boy Scout from Belfast. In Crayfish, there was ex-butcher Corporal Albert Laver, known as Bert, and Bill Mills, who had worked in a sports shop in Kettering. Cachalot was commanded by Bill Ellery, who, at 27, was one of the oldest and a married father of two. His number two was a Brummy, Eric Fisher, a printer before the war. As in the game of cricket, Hasler had a spare man, an ex-grocer called Norman Colley.
I went as spare man just in case anybody got injured. But I had a job to do to help launch the canoes and get them all ready and put all the equipment inside them and help to launch them. So I had a good job there doing that. It was quite a job.
Hasler and his team descending into a submarine.
On the 30th of November, Hasler's men travelled to Scotland to board Royal Navy submarine HMS Tuna. With the exception of Hasler, none of them knew that this was no exercise.
The men gather in a cramped chamber of the sub and look about them with a mixture of subdued anxiety as Hasler walks amongst them.
Once underway, Hasler told his men they were now on operations.
I've been able to tell you before, we've actually started an operation. We're going to be doing the kind of job we've been practicing for these past 4 months. And I chose you choose because I feel confident that you can do it.
Their target was not, as they had all imagined, the Tirpitz in Norway. It was the enemy blockade runners in Bordeaux.
Yes.
There were smiles all round. Getting back from France would be much easier than from Norway. And the sea would be warmer too. So far, so good.
For the Special Forces commander, this is the crucial moment. He has to convince his men that this is a job that must be done. He has to reassure them that he has the plan that will work. And he has, above all, to inspire them with the belief that they can do it.
We are positioned here.
Hasler drew them a map of the Gironde estuary. He plotted their course from the point where the submarine would drop them off. They would use the tides, paddle by night, and lie up during the day.
This is where we should spend our first night. Now, on either side.
Next, he described the German defences. The coast was patrolled by two armed trawlers, six minesweepers, and perhaps 24 torpedo and armed river patrol craft. There were batteries of heavy and medium guns on both sides of the estuary, a radar station at its mouth, maritime patrol aircraft, searchlight batteries, and machine gun posts. If, and it was a big if, they were lucky enough to evade all of these, then, on the fourth night, they would converge separately on Bordeaux and plant limpet mines on the blockade runners.
At this point, Hasler stopped. Any questions, he asked? It was Sergeant Sam Wallace who asked what everyone wanted to know.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes.
How are we getting home? Getting home.
That is regrettable.
Hasler's answer must have chilled them to the bone. The submarine can't come back, he said. It's just too dangerous for them. We're going to have to split into pairs and escape through occupied France and over the Pyrenees into neutral Spain. There were gasps.
I'm afraid it's
but
just
no complaints. Everybody trusted Blondie.
Nevertheless, it must have been dawning on them all that this would be a one-way journey.
You just got to make your own way through France, Spain, to Gibraltar. There was no other way. That why it was a suicide mission, because we couldn't speak French, and we had no idea where it was.
That night, Hasler's men bedded down as best they could in what little space was left on the metal deck of Tuna's forward torpedo compartment. The lucky ones took possession of a sack of potatoes, used as a pillow.
One of them reads a paper in the downtime.
Those who couldn't sleep took the opportunity to write farewell letters to their loved ones. Bobby Ewart, who had celebrated his 21st birthday just the day before, wrote to his 16-year-old sweetheart, Heather.
Dear Heather, I trust it won't be necessary to have this sent to you, but since I don't know the outcome of this little adventure, I thought I'd leave this note. During my stay at Southsea, as you well know, you made me realise what the good things in life are. I couldn't help but love you, Heather, although you were so young. I will always love you as I know you do me. That should get me through this. But one never knows the turn of fate. One thing I ask of you, Heather, is not to take it too hard. You have yet your life to live. Think of me as a good friend. Some lucky fellow will find you who has more sense than I had and who can get you what you deserve. You are young for this sort of thing, but I had to do it. So please don't worry yourself about me. I pray that God will spare me and save you from this misery. So I'll say cheerio and God be with you. Yours forever, Bob. Chin up, sweetheart.
The young brunette is reading the letter tearfully on a beach. A photo of him is included in the envelope. Quietly, she folds them both away.
400 miles away, off the west coast of France, Bobby Ewart and his mates waited patiently for the final call. They had endured 7 days of dodging enemy ships, cramped conditions, and terrible, terrible seasickness.
This, as I recall it, is the very worst moment of an operation. The long, heavy, dragging hours before it all begins. Everyone fills this private space in their own way. I used to check and recheck my equipment, but some will read a last letter from a loved one, look at a photograph, think of home, think of the next pint they have down the pub with their mates when they get back. Some, even those who don't believe in God, will say a silent prayer, well, after a fashion. Are they scared? I can't speak for others, but I used to be. But what they're all longing for is the waiting to end so they can get on with the job.
At a little before dusk, on the 7th of December, Hasler and his team began their last checks for the operation ahead. Hasler confirmed with the sub's captain that they were in the right position, and the order was given: launch the canoes. Hasler's men, faces blackened, followed their canoes up onto the casing of the submarine.
Be ready up there.
On the way out, one canoe, Cachalot, was ripped. Hasler was called down from the bridge. He took one look at the damage and immediately decided that Fisher and Ellery could not take part in the operation. Despite pleading from both men, and even tears from Fisher, Hasler insisted. Now Hasler was down to 10 men. Not an ideal start. Norman Colley was still hoping there might be a place for him.
I was hoping to go, yes, I was. I was disappointed I couldn't go. When Hasler asked if anybody who didn't want to go, make their minds up there and then, I was hoping somebody would say yes, they didn't want to go. He said it didn't matter if they didn't want to go, it didn't hold anything against them. But nobody backed out. That disappointed me.
After a tense 46 minutes, Hasler's team of 10 men were finally on the water. It was 20:03 hours, and there was no time to lose.
The five canoes paddle through darkness across still water. Their occupants are dressed in dark camouflaged gear, and their faces are smeared with camouflage paint. Now, Paddy walking over a sun-kissed bridge past other pedestrians. Then, an aerial view along a wide river.
But, unbeknown to Hasler and his unit as they paddled into danger, there was another operation underway. Organized by the Special Operations Executive, or SOE, their agents had been given exactly the same mission as Hasler and his men, to blow up the German blockade runners in Bordeaux Harbour. Known by some as the Baker Street Irregulars, and others as the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, SOE was defined by one thing above all others: secrecy.
SOE took very seriously the secret element of being a secret service. If you belonged to it, you couldn't tell anybody that you belonged to it. You couldn't tell your own wife, you couldn't tell your own children, you couldn't tell your own mistress. You couldn't tell anybody what you were doing.
And that included combined operations. So, long before Hasler had ever heard of Operation Frankton, SOE had already parachuted into France explosives, a wireless, and their own team of agents led by Claude de Baissac.
And including Charles Hayes and Mary Herbert.
What this meant was that while Hasler was paddling towards the Gironde, de Baissac was already in place, in Bordeaux, in a cafe, right next to the quayside. Here he could see the blockade runners. He could judge when they were full and ready to go. He could choose his moment of attack to do maximum damage.
It's highly unlikely that anybody, however senior, at Combined Ops, was aware that de Baissac was in Bordeaux and was actively planning to attack the same target. But I would be very surprised if SOE didn't know of Hasler's raid in Bordeaux.
This was a Whitehall cock-up on a mighty scale.
So despite almost certainly knowing about Hasler's mission, SOE in London did absolutely nothing to inform combined operations of their own plans. And if they had, Hasler's men may never have had to embark on such a dangerous mission.
Hasler and his team paddling silently through midnight water.
Out on the Gironde, for the first 2 hours, Hasler's canoes, little more than dark shadows on a darker sea, made good progress. With the flood tide behind them, they began sweeping down the coast at increasing speed. Ahead, they could see the dark finger of the Point de Grave lighthouse, marking the entrance to the estuary. Soon, they would be past the German defences and into the protected waters of the Gironde.
The sea becomes rougher.
But then, suddenly, Hasler began to hear an unfamiliar and unexpected sound. Ahead of them was a tidal overfall.
I've paddled in tidal overfalls like this. They're pretty calm today, but they can be absolutely terrifying. They're caused when two tides collide over shallow water. The waves are short, steep, and come from all directions. Hasler's men weren't prepared for this.
The white foaming water crashes around their canoes.
Hasler ordered them to paddle in fast, keep the canoe bows always into the sea, and fight through the turbulence as quickly as possible. They would all then meet up on the other side. Hasler and Sparks paddled furiously into the maelstrom. In a few seconds, they were through and into calmer waters, followed by Laver and Mills in Crayfish, Sheard and Moffat in Conger, and then McKinnon and Conway in Cuttlefish.
The sea becomes calm again.
But where was Bobby Hewitt? where was Sam Wallace? They watched and they waited, but Coldfish was nowhere to be seen. Once there had been 12 men, now there were 8.
They paddle onwards,
hoping they would reunite later. Hasler's team reluctantly moved on. But before they had gone any distance, they heard it again. Another tidal overfall, this time even more ferocious than before. Hasler and Sparks again went first,
paddling straight into the white water,
and waited the other side, panting for breath from the exertion. Suddenly, a cry and a splash. Conger had capsized. Then Sheard and Moffat emerged, clinging onto their canoes and coughing and spluttering in the icy water.
Hasler realized that in this bitter cold, if he didn't act fast, the whole enterprise could be doomed. So he told Sheard to hang on to the back of his boat, Moffat onto the back of McKinnon's. They'd tow them in as far as they could. Then they'd have to swim for it and make their way back home alone.
Their speed was now down to 1 knot because of the drag of the 2 men in the water. Sheard and Moffat, who had been in the sea for almost an hour, were now beginning to suffer badly from the cold. Hasler's mission was in jeopardy, and he was forced to make an agonizing decision.
The canoe comes to a halt, while Blondy considers with a grave expression.
I'm sorry, but we have to leave you here, Hasler told Sheard and Moffat. You must swim for it. I'm terribly sorry. God bless you both. With that, Hasler, with the others following, paddled away into the darkness.
And so 6 became just 3.
There are those who like to see Blondy Hasler as a steely-eyed professional, prepared to sacrifice his men in a suicide mission for glory. But his handling of the plight of his stricken colleagues tells a totally different story. By giving Moffat and Sheard a chance to survive, albeit a very slim one, he was placing his operation in jeopardy and breaking his own rules, which said, in all circumstances, the mission must come first.
Days later, 60 miles up the coast, the frozen body of David Moffat was found washed up on a beach. George Sheard was never seen again. Once, there had been 12 men. Now, there were 6. With his force now reduced to half its original size, Hasler had to put the past behind him and concentrate on what lay ahead, or all would be lost.
He and Ned back up their canoe and paddle away from the others. Now, in an estuary.
They were now out of the open sea. They split up, and their bodies bent over the front of their cockpits, slipped one by one past the heavily guarded mouth of the great estuary. Their nerves taut with anticipation, their spines braced for the fury of shots which would follow discovery. There were no shouts, no shots, but on the other side, no cuttlefish either. Again, they waited and they watched. McKinnon and Conway, too, had now disappeared. We now know they were later captured and executed. Once there had been 12, now there were only 4.
The remaining 2 pairs paddle on regardless up the estuary.
One can only imagine what Haslam must have felt at this point, having lost two-thirds of his force in just 10 hours. But he pressed on. Desperate to find somewhere to land before dawn, he chose a small inlet called Le Pointe aux Oiseaux. It looked suitable, and in many ways, it was.
But, and there's always a but in this story, what Hasler didn't know was that he'd landed right in the middle of one of the key concentrations of German troops in the whole Medoc Peninsula.
A grainy photograph of three adults, one man and two women.
But it wasn't the Germans who found Hasler and his now exhausted men. It was a group of French fishermen.
A quiet, narrow water channel in the estuary.
They pointed Hasler to a nearby spit of land where they said he and his men would be safer.
Blondie Hasler and his men trudged through thick mud.
The canoes were dragged up into cover, and the fishermen helped to raise their tracks.
A stiff breeze rustling through dense shrubs.
Later on that day, they returned to give Hasler and his team some bread, chocolate, pâté, and a half-empty bottle of wine.
To Jeanne Baudray, who was 18 years old when she met Blondie Hasler and his team.
Quand vous êtes arrivé sur place pour leur donner à manger, que leur avez-vous donné à manger?
The grey-haired Jeanne replies, "When I arrived, I wanted to give them something to make it special. We didn't have much, but I brought them some hot fresh bread to cheer them up. I also brought them some chocolate." She continues, "We were as pleased to give it as they were to receive it." In the reconstruction, Hasler and his men consume the provisions in their canoes in a sheltered rivulet.
These local fishermen were not French resistance. They were just fishermen. Yet they agreed without hesitation to help, knowing that that could lead them to the firing squad and put their families at risk of deportation. Afterwards, they swore amongst themselves never to tell anyone of what they'd seen. And they kept that promise till the war was over.
With some food inside them, Hasler's men could rest a while before the next stage of their mission began.
Jeanne recalls, "I found the men really exhausted. But there is a nautical expression.
Ils avaient, comme on dit dans la marine, un mât de sauvetage parce que Hasler était.
They had Hasler as their mainstay. When I saw him, of course he was handsome and strong.
Qui était pas bon, il était beau, grand, etc. Mais surtout,
but his inner strength was apparent. He was steadfast. Nothing could affect him, and he would complete his mission.
A little before 2300, the Marines pulled the camouflage nets off catfish and crayfish and hauled them across more than half a mile of mud to the water's edge.
Large rocks are also strewn across the mire to add further obstacles to their nighttime launch.
At 23:30 hours, just over 24 hours after they had set off, Hasler and the three remaining Marines launched their canoes once again into the flooding tide and set off for the other side of the estuary. The weather was calm and clear, with a slight haze hanging over the water. They made good progress. On their second night, they covered 25 miles in just 6 hours.
Hasler and his three remaining men paddling with smooth proficiency.
Wallace and Ewart lost in the tide race that first night. Were not so lucky. They had already been captured. Stumbling ashore exhausted, they had knocked at the wrong door. Instead of French patriots, they had blundered into a German platoon. They were sent for interrogation, ending up here in the Place de Tourny in Bordeaux, in the hands of the Gestapo. As commandos, they were subject to Hitler's infamous and illegal commando order, which stated that all those captured on raids were to be immediately executed. Although young Bobby Ewart said nothing, the Germans gleaned significant information from the equipment found in their canoe and from the interrogation of Sergeant Wallace. On the 9th of December 1942, German Supreme Headquarters in Berlin knew almost everything. They knew that they had been landed by submarine, they knew that they were from combined ops, and they knew that their mission was to travel up the Gironde estuary and attach limpet mines to German ships in Bordeaux. But what they didn't know, and what Sergeant Wallace didn't tell them, was that he and Ewart were not the only participants in the raid.
Hasler and his men were out there, somewhere, armed, dangerous, determined to press home their attack.
The Germans were convinced that they were dealing with an operation which was over, instead of one which was still in progress. It was this conviction which let Hasler and his men through. The Germans should have flooded the river with searchlights and patrols, but they didn't. Hasler and his team were able to continue undetected, paddling closer and closer to their targets. But by now, Hasler's men too were feeling the effects. Cold, wet, cramped, stiff, exposed, sleepless, they lived every second with the fear of imminent discovery, capture, and death. Hasler had lost two-thirds of his force. He was now in the very heart of enemy territory. Danger and discovery lurked at every bend in the river, yet they were still only halfway to their target. I think at this point Hasler must have wondered whether against these odds they could possibly make it. And if they did, what difference could it make? So few men left, so little explosive, and then what? Capture? Torture, death before a firing squad. This must have been one of Hasler's lowest moments. As Hasler and his men paddled on towards Bordeaux, Ewart and Wallace took a different and final journey. They were driven to an execution site in an army camp at Souges, just outside Bordeaux. They were accompanied by two wooden coffins.
Photographs of the two men in uniform.
At Souges, they were led forward and tied to two wooden stakes. A firing squad of 16 men leveled their rifles. The order was given to fire. The two Marines were then finished off by the Gestapo, with shots to the back of the head. On December the 9th, a Portsmouth newspaper reported that a small British sabotage squad had been engaged at the mouth of the Gironde River and finished off in combat. The item was spotted by 16-year-old Heather Powell, Bobby Ewart's sweetheart. Convinced that this was connected with her beloved Bobby, Heather became deeply depressed. She fell ill and was taken to hospital. Here she was diagnosed with advanced tuberculosis. She died days later of her illness, and some say of a broken heart. She was one day short of her 17th birthday. Journey's end was also approaching for Hasler and his men. Undetected by an alerted enemy, with his prey now no more than a stone's throw away, Hasler had now penetrated more than 50 miles downriver.
Hasler hid his canoes in the reeds, just over there. The main port of Bordeaux is 2 miles in that direction. He was now so close to the city that he could hear the rumble of traffic, the hooting of cars, the barking of dogs. He could also hear the whir and clank of the cranes on this quay. Hasler and his men were now within touching distance of their prey.
So release the acid. We need to twist that.
At around 2100, Hasler gave the order to arm their limpet mines and prepare for the attack. They shook hands and wished each other good luck. And then, quietly, they pushed aside the reeds and slipped out into the darkness. Crayfish heading off to the east bank of the river and catfish making her way upstream towards the Quai des Chartrons.
Paddy's walking along the river in daylight.
But they were not the only ones heading for the ships on the Quai des Chartrons that night. Claude de Bessac and his SOE team were also making the final preparations for their attack at the very same time. De Bessac's job was more simple. He could carry explosives directly onto the ships, hidden in the haversacks of his agents who were working as painters.
So while Hasler and his men were making their final approach, having paddled 70 miles deep into enemy territory, Claude de Bessac and his team had to walk only 100 yards from their headquarters, just down there, straight to their targets, right under German noses.
Meanwhile, for Hasler and his men, everything now depended on the last 2 miles. They needed maximum concentration, absolute stealth, if they were to have any chance of completing their mission. Paddles dipping in and out of the water with minimum noise and disturbance, Hasler hugged the bank of the river until he got to the port and then tucked Catfish into the deep shadows cast by the quayside to observe his targets. What he saw was a cluster of ships, amongst them a large cargo vessel called the Tannenfels, whose riverside flank was fully exposed. It was a perfect target. He allowed Catfish to slip silently on the flood tide down the ship's side. They were now abreast of the great ship's engine room. They could hear the hum of its auxiliary engines, even catch snatches of conversation and music coming from the crew's quarters.
Blondie gives Ned a thumbs up.
Hasler took off his gloves and reached below his cockpit for the first limpet. He gently attached it, feeling a small jolt, which told him that the magnets had taken hold. The first blow had been struck. After their second limpet was planted, they began to make their way towards the stern to find a place for the third.
The bow of the great ship towers over them. Hasler glances back and shares a nod with his crewman.
Suddenly, there was a loud clang from above. Glancing upwards, they saw the clear outline of a sentry silhouetted against the sky. The two marines tried to melt into their canoes and stayed stock still. They had no option now but to rely on their camouflage and their training. Hasler said later, "I felt as though my back had been stripped naked." Minutes turned into what felt like hours as they waited and waited for the shout and the shot. But none came. Mistaken for a log or a piece of flotsam, their camouflage and their discipline saved them. Finally, Hasler gave the signal to Sparks to let go, and they drifted out, the tide now carrying them with increasing speed downstream and away from danger. Hasler's limpet mines would start to explode in 6 hours' time. The job was done. The mission was accomplished. As soon as they were clear of the harbour lights, Hasler turned in his cockpit and, grasping Sparks' hand, shook it warmly. Then the two men shot off downstream, paddling hard. They had just 6 hours to cover the next 20 miles. But now they were swept on by an ebb tide and spurred forward by the elation of success. And then more good news when they came across Laver and Mills. They too were in high spirits. They had planted 8 limpet mines on another 2 ships.
The pairs part company again.
At 3:50 a.m., the first of Frankton's bombs began to go off. For the next 8 hours, successive explosions ripped holes in the sides of the blockade runners and water began to pour into their holds. Unfortunately, the tide was now low and the ships were empty. Later that morning, the BASAC's team, still preparing their own attack, heard the explosions. To say that de Bessac was not pleased would be an understatement.
He said we were well on the way to attacking these ships, but then, at the critical moment, the unfortunate commando raid took place. The only result was the ships settled a meter or so onto the bottom and were quickly refloated, but we had to abandon our attack altogether.
So far as I know, de Bessac, he was given no warning that Frankton was going to take place. He was furious that somebody else had sunk them when he'd put so much effort into the sinking of them. After all, there were his targets and there they were sinking. But one can understand anyone who's put a great deal of effort into something, somebody else goes and does all the work under their noses, one is somewhat put out. Would you blame him?
While de Bessac fumed at the missed opportunity, Hasler and his team split into pairs and began their long and desperate journey home. Had London coordinated with SOE's network on the ground, Hasler's men need never have travelled any more than a mile or so before being scooped up and whisked to safety by the French resistance. Instead, their journey involved more than 70 miles in the depth of winter through enemy-occupied France, a furious enemy on their tails, and without shelter, food, or assistance beyond what they could beg. Only Hasler and Sparks made it. After an extraordinary journey across France, Spain, and into Gibraltar, they finally arrived home in March 1943. Laver and Mills were captured, and then, like their colleagues, executed. Once there had been 12 men. Now, there were just two. On Sunday, the 25th of April, 1943, Blondie Hasler was invited to tea at Louis Mountbatten's home. There, he related, for the first time, the full story of Operation Frankton. Although Frankton had cost almost every one of Hasler's men, he had still, against all the odds, completed his mission. Limpet mines had been successfully planted on blockade runners in Bordeaux and had blown a hole in German illusions of invincibility. Mountbatten and Churchill recognized what Hasler and his team had achieved, awarding Hasler the highest medal possible for this kind of operation, the DSO. Sparks was given a DSM.
Looking back, even over 70 years, Operation Frankton still stands out. It was one of the very first deep penetration raids by special forces which had genuine strategic purpose. There have been many such canoe-based raids since, but to my mind, this was the greatest of them. It was the raid which gave birth to my old unit, the SBS, and it's the raid which has inspired me all my adult life.
The Germans, too, recognized Frankton as something quite exceptional. One German officer called it the outstanding commando raid of the Second World War.
But in this story, one big question remains. Did Mountbatten know of SOE's planned attack? We may never know the answer to that question for certain, but one thing is very clear. With Whitehall factions more interested in fighting each other than in working together to beat the Germans, this was a Whitehall cock-up of major proportions. And the people who paid the price were Hasler's young Marines.
From photographs of Hasler and his men to one of Mountbatten, Norman Colley.
Mountbatten, he was in charge of a combined ops then, and he gave the okay for the operation. So it was on his head, really. He said it was worthwhile losing those men, which is in a different position to us. I must say, our lives were not as much important to him as what the operation was.
Along with the lost lives, one of the biggest tragedies of Frankton was the lost opportunity to strike a much more effective blow against our enemy. Hasler and de Baissac working together could have made a much bigger impact.
It was fairly clear by, at the latest, Christmas, that there had been a major cock-up, in that Frankton had taken place and had sunken its ships at a horrible cost in casualties, 80%, which is much too much. And equally, SOE's effort had been well prepared, but a great waste, as it turned out, of resources and effort.
By the time Frankton was over, the need for better cooperation was at long last being recognised in Whitehall. In the summer of 1943, a control system was established in the Admiralty precisely to prevent the wasteful duplication of effort, courage and endeavour that had made Frankton so notorious.
A new official was set up in Whitehall called the controlling officer, who made sure that this particular type of model never happened again. The people didn't trip each other up in precisely the way that SOE had been tripped up by combined ops in Operation Franklin. Next to the actual sinkings, the clearinghouse was, I think, the most important result of Franklin.
Professor Foote, SOE historian.
As the war progressed, SOE and combined ops began to turn away from the pinprick raids of the past to something rather grander.
You could certainly maintain that the setting up of the controlling office after Frankton was an assistance to wars. The major cooperation between all three armed forces and all the secret services that worked so well in the end in Normandy D-Day.
Thousands of troops storming the Normandy beaches from ships.
What stands out for me from this story is not the interdepartmental rivalries in Whitehall, the petty squabbles, the cruel twists of fate. It is the extraordinary loyalty, determination, and courage of those ordinary young men who followed Blondie Hasler into the heart of the enemy that cold December night in 1942. In an age of easy living, where we are seldom asked to choose between ourselves and something greater, they should be an inspiration to us all.
Herbert George Blondie Hasler, DSO OBE. After the war, Hasler competed in the single-handed transatlantic race. Aged 51, he married and had two children. In later life, he became an advocate of organic farming. He died in 1987, aged 73. William Edward Bill Sparks, DSM. After the war, Sparks took several jobs. Aged 61, he recreated part of Operation Frankton for cancer research. He died in 2002, aged 80.